Kerry Cavanaugh, professor of diplomacy and conflict resolution at the University of Kentucky.
And you're a former ambassador, so you worked for the State Department for many, many years.
I did. 22 years at the State Department. I had worked as a regular Foreign Service officer and then a peace mediator and negotiator for the United States.
And we wanted to talk to you today about this article. It came out on Tuesday from Politico, but other media outlets are reporting the same thing, this idea that a Trump budget, the proposed budget that he's working on, one of those drafts includes a 37% cut to the State Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development. Your reaction when you heard that?
I was very surprised at that. We saw President Trump in his first address to the nation talked about increasing the defense budget $54 billion. And this report came out in conjunction with word that all the federal agencies would get budget numbers this week. And the initial statement was expect a reduction of a third or more in the budgets of state and USAID, which together would actually be about the size of the defense budget increase. The problem with that is it reflects a lack of understanding in part of what the State Department and USAID do. There has always been a view in the American public that we give away an enormous amount of foreign aid and that we get little in return for that. But the reality is that's not true. The state and aid together account for about 1% of the federal budget. The money that USAID does give out, most of it is directly tied to national security. So we're looking at two agencies here who really are national security agencies, and what they're doing tends to decrease the need for defense appropriations. As I mentioned, I had been a peace mediator for the United States. My former boss, who became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, used to comment that when state was successful in those kind of endeavors, it meant our soldiers, our sailors, didn't have to go to war. It is a lot cheaper to send a few guys to Geneva to negotiate through a problem than to move a carrier battle group to the Persian Gulf. So the basic diplomacy part, great bang for the buck. On the USAID, much of that money is tied to efforts to provide defense to partners and allies. They're money that enables other countries to buy military equipment from us. Some of it's tied to pay for international peacekeepers that the UN deploys around the world as part of our share of UN contributions. But we would prefer that residents of Fiji and maybe Bangladesh and even the United Kingdom be peacekeepers than American troops. Other parts go to eliminate diseases like malaria, Ebola, HIV, which certainly is in American security interest. So this idea of a contraction so large is very hard to fathom.
If it were to come to that, and we've already seen Lindsey Graham say it's dead on arrival. Mitch McConnell said probably not that this would pass. But if it did go through, a 37% reduction, what is the State Department doing now that it would no longer be able to do?
I think, one, if it's in all the aid, the United States would no longer be seen as an international leader on humanitarian and disaster relief efforts. That would all disappear. We would stop providing military equipment to countries that are helping us in the defense of our nation. We would reduce the American diplomatic presence overseas, which would mean Americans that get in trouble when they're traveling might not have anywhere to go. But it sends a signal of an American withdrawal from the diplomatic process, the give and take, the normal diplomacy that makes the world work, and it does a disservice to the president. The president relies on a foreign policy toolkit, and in that toolkit are diplomatic levers, military levers, development, intelligence things. It literally is turning his toolkit into a box of hammers. And if every time there's a problem in the world and the president looks to see what could I do, if all he has at his disposal are hammers, military action, you're going to find the United States gets in a lot more trouble because anyone who works around the house knows sometimes you need a wrench, sometimes you need a screwdriver, and if you whack on everything with a hammer, you start breaking a lot of stuff.
And if the U.S. no longer fills that role, who fills the vacuum?
That's the other piece. As you withdraw from that, already China is saying it will pick up the slack on international trade. It'll become the promoter of trade. We would have some countries willing to help Americans in need if the United States shut down its operations there. But that becomes problematic. We are best able to serve our people. Our people are most comfortable coming to our missions. The other piece of this pie, a substantial amount of money at the State Department now is spent on security. We saw with Benghazi, with turmoil abroad, it can be very expensive to operate embassies in dangerous areas. At the same time, the interface they provide with the country they're in, the support they provide for Americans is profound, and the information those embassies provide back to the United States of what's going on in that country is significant. For example, today in Afghanistan, we have almost 9,000 troops. We have a significant American engagement. This is the longest running war in American history now. There are four American journalists, two from the New York Times, one from the Washington Post, one from the Wall Street Journal. They don't get out in the country much. If you want to advance the interests of the United States in a country where we're at war, you need to maintain a fairly significant embassy, both to communicate with the government, how do you win this fight, how do you fight terrorism here, and to communicate back to Washington what's happening in the field. And if you're reducing things by 30 to 37%, I don't know how you maintain that footprint. I don't know how you maintain that ability to communicate what we need, to create partnerships with our friends, and to relay back what really is going on around the world.
I probably shouldn't ask a diplomat about an additional $54 billion in spending on military, but are we in a country right now that needs that much of an overhaul for our military?
It becomes always a hard issue to fathom. So it's not as significant an increase as the president suggested. We've had increases of that magnitude four times since 9/11. So this is a fairly common bump. I think the key in the military is spending it the right way and making sure you're putting the investments in the equipment and the personnel you need for the long term. I think that's an issue that the Pentagon needs to grapple with, but it's not simply an issue of how many planes do you have, how many ships do you have. The Navy has gotten smaller. I used to be a foreign policy advisor for the U.S. Navy, but in fact, our ships are better. So you can't say that the Navy's weaker. In fact, I would argue today it's stronger, and it's more focused on that mission and how you do it best. The Army is in a similar strait. I think there is some truth to there's a difficulty with our troops in that we are still engaged in two wars. They get tired. They need training. Families decide enough of five or six deployments. It's time to move back to the private sector, and they need to be replaced. There may be some need for additional revenue there, but we continue to spend more than the next seven countries combined. It's not a case where we're at threat due to our military posture.
Rex Tillerson hasn't been on the job for very long, but your impressions of what he's doing as Secretary of State?
So I think he made a great impression his first day at the State Department. He came in, had a meeting with all the employees, and really gave a presentation that was unifying and a focus on we're all in this together and we've got an important mission to make. I was a little disheartened to see he wasn't included in the meetings with the Israeli Prime Minister. He's not been very visible on the public scene, and that may be because the administration is still trying to sort out what its foreign policy will be. It was somewhat surprising that in the president's first address to the nation, to Congress, that there was very little foreign policy in there. There was a discussion about immigration. There were renewed discussions about infrastructure and healthcare, and those are important. and should have been there, but there weren't many clues about what the United States is going to do internationally, how we're going to engage, how we're going to either continue on the paths we were, promoting security, democracy, stability, or go in a different direction. And I think at some point, Secretary of State Tillerson is going to have to find a way to convey that message to the world.
And possibly do it without the money that he thought that he was going
to
have.
Well, I think if these cuts were to take place, I think he would find it almost impossible to do that. That would signify a different focus of the United States in the global arena. We would not be diplomatic leaders if really we're going to withdraw from that significantly from assistance, from participation in international activities, from even the United Nations. We pay dues as part of a share representing our gross domestic product. But if we're not going to pay those dues, we aren't going to call as many shots at the UN. We'll maintain our veto. We can say no to things. But, if we say we really should have international peacekeepers in Syria, if you don't pay any money, your voice doesn't count the same. If you say, well, we really need to feed these people after this tsunami or earthquake in Africa or Asia, if you provide no humanitarian assistance, you don't have the best say in that. And if the only assistance you can provide is we'll send an aircraft carrier or we'll deploy the Army or the Marines, those tools aren't best suited for that action. I should add, in that state USAID budget, you would also find the Peace Corps. You would also find the money we provide Israel and Egypt every year not to go to war with one another. These funds are important funds. I don't know how happy these countries would be if you say, oh, by the way, the commitment we made at Camp David long ago to maintain peace and stability in the Middle East, we can't afford that now.
What about Nikki Haley with the UN and her role in all of this?
I think she's done a very good job as she's sort of learning the ways of how that institution works. I think the challenge she's faced is that she needs better guidance from Washington as to where the White House and the president stand on some of these foreign policy issues. She was actually criticizing Russia at the very same time the president was praising Putin. And it leads to a challenge for foreign interlocutors to know which one is the U.S. policy. Is it what Nikki Haley says and complains about? She complained about bombings in Syria just this last week in the U.N. Security Council. But we didn't hear anything about Syria last night in the president's speech. So there's a real disconnect in how do you know who speaks authoritatively for the United States? The assumption is always the president. But if the president says one thing on Russia and the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State and the ambassador of the UN say something different, it's hard if you imagine a foreign government for their foreign minister or prime minister or their ambassador in Washington to know, what do you report back? Where does the United States stand on these vital questions of peace and security and stability?
Do you have an opinion of Steve Bannon on the National Security Council?
I think that's a mistake. I think the commentary that's come out after that was made public has been pretty clear that discussion, what you get in the National Security Council, is really a discussion of core security interests to the United States. There's things that are threatening us, and that's what's at play there. And that's not the place to have a player who's looking at it from the political optic. Will this help the president if he runs for re-election? Will this help the president if he needs to go campaign for more funds? And it doesn't matter if it's Donald Trump or Barack Obama or Bill Clinton. That kind of figure in that meeting becomes a distraction at minimum and a danger if those perceptions sway. What do we do best to protect the United States? The president always has, all presidents have, political advisors. Steve Bannon can advise the president. Steve Bannon may be the last one to talk to the president before he makes a decision. But in that core meeting where you're bringing a team, and this institution was established after World War II in 1947 with the view the United States needed this kind of construct. How do you bring the key professionals from the intelligence community, the diplomatic leaders, the defense leaders together to get opinion on key issues of U.S. security to present to the president? That should be pretty pure. And I think if he's not in that, doesn't detract from his ability to talk to the president, but it guarantees that product is focused where it should be, not on politics, but on security.
More than 120 retired generals and admirals apparently released a letter earlier this week that they sent to lawmakers about this very idea. They are not in favor of it. Could that have any sway whatsoever on someone who, you know, like Donald Trump, who only values certain matters of input?
I think it could, because I think it highlights again that inside the practicing parts of the U.S. government, there's an understanding, there's a profound understanding in defense that going to war is a bad thing. That's your last choice. You know, the other options are always better. And I think they recognize that the State Department and USAID have done jobs they can't do. They don't want that toolkit to be just hammers. We saw in Iraq and Afghanistan the idea, and Congress helped with this in a bad way, by funding significantly appropriations for defense, not state or USAID, we would have Marines in the Army building schools. But then at night, we would have the Marines and the Army fighting in the village. This is very confusing to locals. And Marines aren't trained to build schools. The Army isn't trained to build schools. They're trained to fight. They're warriors. They should be warriors. That's their intent. USAID hires people who build schools. The Peace Corps goes out and teaches English. That's a job they do better, trained for, signed up for, than having the armed forces do it. And I think that letter from the 120 admirals and generals showed it's like, we need this. This helps our mission. You get, to use an Eisenhower expression, more bang for the buck if you have the whole panoply of tools in the toolkit and you're using the right tool for the right job.
You obviously still have contacts within the State Department. I'm going to make an assumption here. And not asking you to name names, but I mean, what are you hearing from them?
As I said, this speech when Secretary Tillerson arrived at the State Department is very well received. And I think he personally is held in high regard. I think there's a morale issue surrounding the slowness of appointments and identification of who will be leading certain divisions of the State Department. The president, all the political appointee ambassadors to leave as of the day of the inauguration. I think that sounds worse than it is. There are functioning number two State Department officials who do very good jobs in all these countries. But normally, the president's foreign policy interests are expressed by political appointees in every agency of government. And these would be on in track for confirmation, coming online, and they signal, what do you want? How do we get that? How are we going to work with you to do that? There hasn't been a lot of movement on those positions. I think they're frustrated by that. And then when they see this report that in theory came out of the Office of Management and Budget, that this huge budgetary reduction may be coming, I think that sends a very bad signal. They were initially, the entire department, also under the federal hiring freeze. Foreign Service officers got an exemption on that, so they were able to form a new diplomatic class. That's good, but again, it's raising questions on manpower over the medium and long term. We need those new diplomats to go out and help deal with visas and immigration and those security questions. The president is put at the top of his list. So the State Department has a role in advancing his both foreign policy and domestic agenda, but they're worried, is it going to have the budget to meet that mission?
We know what you want to happen. What do you think will happen here?
I think Congress will intervene and make sure there's not a cut that drastic. I suspect Senator John McCain may intervene and argue for more money for defense. than the president has even talked about. I think the reality is for the defense, if you spend it the right way, we'll get pretty far. On state and USAID, just like domestic programs like Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security, a lot of those monies can't easily be touched. An unsecure embassy is dangerous, so you've got to have the basic security to operate an embassy. If you have a budget cut, it means you reduce the functioning part of that embassy, but you've maintained the security, that starts getting kind of silly. You know, it'd be like having a really pretty shiny car, but it can't drive because you failed to buy the gas. No, we need the gas to make it function. So I think you've got to be more careful on that budget. And I think the long-term gains of a lot of the foreign assistance of things like the Peace Corps are often underappreciated. This is part of what delivers America's position in the world. We don't want to be the largest military power on the planet. That's not the thing you particularly want to be known for, even though today we are. No, we say the President of the United States is the leader of the free world. Leader of the free world does more than tap military resources, taps his panoply of resources.
Well, we'll leave it right there. Retired U.S. Ambassador Kerry Cavanaugh, thanks for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.